I assume some of you are familiar with the preacher E.V. Hill. He's this big black guy who speaks with this deep, growly kind of voice. And I've heard it said of him that he spoke at a Moody's Founders Week some time back and had about a dozen points that he was wanting to make, but was only able to get through six of them, and then he just stopped when his time was up. The next year, he was invited to come back, and he started with, "Seventhly." Well, we're going to be almost doing the same thing. Maybe not quite so abrupt. Hope to do a little bit of review, but just to get us back in. Because we started in this passage, 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 through 15. And I realized there was so much here, I really needed to break it into at least two, perhaps three. We'll see how far we get today. And so... we had looked at the manner of presentation before God because the passage was up to this point was dealing with prayer, that we ought to pray. One of the things that needed to be set in order in the church in Ephesus where Timothy was helping out, where Paul is writing to him, the matter of prayer needed to have some points of clarification, encouraging them to do it and within some certain parameters. And so the passage went like this. "I desire, therefore, that the men pray everywhere." And we noted that it was the men as in the males, lifting up holy hands. And we noted that the emphasis is on holy, not on the hands. The lifting of hands was a common practice at that time, but it was holy, without wrath and doubting, perhaps better without anger and argument or dissension. In like manner, also, that the women, and it's talking about the females here, adorn themselves in modest apparel. There must have been something going on at the time that needed some point of clarification. There may have been, and this, you have to think about, okay, what was the culture like in Ephesus at this time? Just like it was in Corinth at the time, there were issues there as well. And there needed to be some propriety and moderation in the dress and so on. And so he notes then, "but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works." And so that's kind of the focus here. And so we asked the question, why was he dealing with this? And we noted there's always a reason why a biblical author writes. There is something going on in that context that had to be addressed. And there were many times when there were corrective things. And so there was some issues. We have to keep that in mind. There's probably some corrective issue going on here. And this was to counteract false teaching. One of the first things he talks about in chapter 1 is false teaching and standing firm on doctrinal truth. And that's going to be throughout the book as well. And this was also addressed in the context of church meetings. Not everywhere, but in the context of where the church was meeting together. And then we noted the expectations for the men. They should eliminate distractions to prayer, argument, anger and argument, and major or focus on holiness, holy hands, that which they do. The lifting up of hands has to do with one's doing and in holiness. And then the expectations for the women, again, just really simplifying here, they should eliminate the distractions of outward appearance and major on godliness and good works. And so that's just really bringing it down. That was the end of part one. No intermission. We move on. The command for submission in God's order. As we come to the next couple of verses here. And I would note as we move into this that this is somewhat of a divergence from our comfort level when we deal with some of the matters that are addressed here. And it's somewhat, I would put it like this, it is a radical veering into oncoming culture. And that's a picture that you can kind of imagine. A radical veering into oncoming culture. How do we deal with this? Well, first of all, we have to come back to, okay, what does the text say? What does it mean for then? And then what does it mean for now? Hopefully we can come to some understanding of that. So that's what we will be working on. So, verses 11 and 12. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. I didn't hear any amens. I wasn't expecting that I would, however. How do we deal with that? What is this talking about? We need to understand the cultural context. Anytime we're dealing with particularly the epistles, because they were occasional in that they were dealing with a specific situation, we have to recognize that. Some underlying questions that we want to think about. What was normal conduct then? What was going on in the meetings at that time that would be helpful to know? What is this text suggesting for then? And how was it addressing a problem at that time? And then what are the implications for now? How are things different from then to now? Is that something we have to take into account? And how do we distinguish cultural conditioning and the principles involved? How do we distinguish what the basic principle is and the practice that carries over to today? We need to think about that. So we need to recognize, okay, what is the principle behind the action or the practice that's there? And can they be separated? Is there a distinction? Then the basic emphasis. Regarding their participation in the meetings of the church, and again, chapter 3, verse 15 specifically indicates that that's what this is dealing with, Paul taught that the women were to let the men provide the public instruction and leadership. When we look at this passage as a whole, that's what we see. This did not mean that women should surrender their minds and consciences to men, but that they should voluntarily take the position of learners in church meetings. And this is helpful to recognize. There's a note in the NET Bible that says this was a radical and liberating departure from the Jewish view that women were not to learn the law. I mean, we're so accustomed that everybody gets equal education. It's just the norm. But back then, the women didn't get to learn the law. That wasn't part of what they did. In fact, according to author Craig Keener, he said ancient society rarely allowed teaching roles to women. So this was, in fact, a major concession for that day. But again, we have to think, okay, what are the implications for our day? Now, it can be argued that typically the women should not accept the role of teacher of the congregation or of the leader of a whole church. That should, at the very least, be evident. And some would also argue that this is supported by the fact that the verbs teach and exercise authority are in the present tense in the original, which implies that this has to do with a continuing ministry rather than a single instance of ministry. Then we want to think about the selection of key terms. And we're going to look at a few more things along the way, but just to keep moving here. The terms teach and have authority over a man seem to refer to separate activities that Paul restricted to men. So they are distinguished, because some have said, well, one is an example of the other or something of that nature. It should be noted here also that Paul did not employ his usual term for the normal exercise of authority, which would be exousia. So some of you would recognize that. But he chose an unusual word, authentēo. And that would carry negative connotations, such as to usurp or to misappropriate authority or to domineer. So some would recognize that there is a distinction in the terms that are used here. The unusual term probably signifies an unusual situation. In Ephesus, the context at least here seems to suggest that at least some women had misappropriated authority by taking upon themselves the role of teacher. and this may have been a cause of a problem there. We don't know what the problem exactly was, but we have an idea of what was suggested as the solution. And then we can ask the question, would this solution be helpful today, or would it be applicable today? Looking again at verse 11, let a woman learn in silence with all submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. So that's very much not the norm in our culture today. And as a matter of fact, there's been a lot of effort to counteract that kind of thinking, as we're very much aware. So then we need to understand the nature of submission. This almost goes without saying. Some people react strongly to the call for submission. In any context. But there seems to be good reason for it. There are a number of passages, not only this 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, 1 Corinthians chapter 14, Ephesians 5, Colossians 3 also deal with this. So it's not isolated. There's several other places where it's referenced. So we need to think, okay, what does this word mean here? Because it says, learn in silence with all submission. So there's something to do here with the idea of submission. There's an order or a rank that is in view. And the Greek word here, hypotage, means to rank under. And it's a military type of term that would be recognized. And we know that in that context, a private would be ranked under a colonel. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the private is of less value or possesses less ability to the superior officer. It just notes there's a difference of rank. Rank has to do with order and authority, not personal superiority or inferiority. And so we want to obviously recognize that. And when we think about the idea of submission, there's somebody else we need to think about, and that is Jesus. When Jesus came to this earth, he typified, he illustrated, he was the ultimate example of submission, of someone who had higher authority, came in, took the rank, the place of humanity, and submitted himself as he did to his parents, Luke 2:51, but also in the whole incarnation event. Philippians 2:5 through 11 is clear on that. And also, it should be recognized that God will reward his submission to the Father, and likewise, it would be our expectation that he will reward women who submit to his will as unto the Lord, as it's referenced in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 and 7. There is a need to understand the breadth of submission. As well, the prohibition to teach seems to have been considering teaching or leading a whole congregation. It's not likely that this would preclude women from teaching or leading some groups within the church that we would commonly recognize as subgroups, provided that they do so with the approval of the formal male leadership of the church, because that emphasis seems to be clear. Because you have a problem. It would seem to me that there might be a problem anyway. If we were to say that when a woman comes into the context of the church, we tend to think buildings, but it's wherever we assemble, that they must put on a piece of duct tape. And nary a word or sound should emanate from them. Now, I realize there's probably a few people who are kind of wishing it were so. But, not to point out Gabriel back there, who's got this big grin on his face, and he's saying, yes! He's thinking of his sister in particular, but we can identify with where you're coming from. But what about singing? That's not silence. What about talking? What about participating in any way? I mean, are we ruling all of those things out? Those are things we have to think about. If we take it at its face value, and some do, do we have to look beyond that? Is there anything else that we need to think about? It's also assumed that this is describing a typical church situation in which there were men who were available who could provide the teaching and the leadership. But if men were absent, perhaps exceptions might be necessary to achieve the higher goals of the church. There have been many occasions where that has been the case, where the men were called off to war and there was nobody else around, and so the women would take responsibility to handle things. That has been done. But is that the expectation? Is that the norm? We need to think about that. There have been occasions historically where a woman has provided leadership. In biblical times, we think of Deborah, for instance. And so there was a need at that time. So we do see there were occasions where there was something other than the normal expectation. It's also important to recognize that submission is an attitude as well as an action, and it's again a recognition of the established rank and function for designed purposes. We see that very clearly in the military context, and we see that the expectation that Paul is communicating here also is to be in the church situation. It's not to be a demeaning kind of thing. It's to be practically functional under God, because that's how he designed it to be, as we will see. And it's in the context of the church, it's not imposed from above. Now, in the context of the military, it is. I mean, you can impose anything you want to in that context. Because they essentially will tell you, we own you now. But it's for that purpose. That's not the way it's supposed to be in the church. It's not imposed from above, it comes from within, and Christ perfectly exemplified that. And we all must submit in some context or another. Under God, under government, under any kind of leadership in whatever context, and on it goes. But today there is a general resistance to any kind of submission, particularly in the context of the home or in the context of the church to some degree, when we look at it a whole. But the most serious context of resisting submission is of failing to submit to faith in Christ. And that is obviously a serious problem in our world as a whole. But one to think about as well, because that involves submission. Submission to faith in Christ, submission to the Word of God in general. That's submission as well. Understand the limiting factors. The issue of teaching. As we had noted, women were not normally taught. So how could they be in a position to teach? If that were the case at that time, that would certainly make some sense. Again, we need to think about, okay, what does the text say? What does it mean for then, for now? And exactly what was Paul prohibiting women from doing in this passage? The basic emphasis. The text indicates that a woman is not to teach a man or to exercise authority over a man in the local church settings is clear from the overall context, because that's what was at issue, because Paul made it clear that he was setting things in order for the church while Paul was away, and he's doing this focused on Timothy. We also see that the teaching of Scripture is in view. Again, 1 Timothy 3:15 reminds us of that. And this seems to be appropriate to the male's function in the church as a mediator between God and people. When we look at how that has been historically communicated and understood, and the emphasis on prayer that man is to take that responsibility and to serve as an authoritative figure under God, and he's going to make that clear in other places as well. So essentially, Paul forbade women from regularly teaching men in local church corporate worship, again, in a more formal context. So whatever the specific application of teaching here, it seems to be that kind of teaching that gives women a position of authority over men, if we look at it in the larger scheme of things. It's also evident that Paul approved of women teaching women and children. Titus 2, 3, and 3 to 5, 2 Timothy 1, verse 5. Timothy himself was taught by his mother and grandmother. Also, Priscilla, along with Aquila. I can never get that name right, depending on how you want to pronounce it, anglicized or not. Acts 18:26 notes that Aquila and Priscilla were involved in teaching Apollos in a private context. It would also probably apply in the situation of reading a book that a woman has written would be an example of a private instruction as well. So if we understand that, then verse 12 does not seem to to forbid a woman from all teaching, but predominantly it seems to be in view prohibiting the headship of woman in the Christian community. And in light of the whole idea of exercising authority, that seems to be the case. And we've already noted something about this word that's used here. It seems to have the idea of to act on one's own authority or to act in an autocratic manner. To exercise authority in that way would have the idea of submitting to no higher authority in the church. And so what we're seeing is that God has an order in view that he has put in place, and he expects us to follow that order. It's also interesting to note here that Paul does not use office terminology of bishop or presbyter, but rather functional terminology of teaching or exercising authority. So that would note that it's the activity that he prohibits, not just the office. And if the activity is prohibited, then it probably has implications for the office, especially when you look at the context of 1 Timothy chapter 2 and chapter 3. What's chapter 3 dealing with? Those who are serving as elders and deacons in the context of the church. So this is really leading into that. And for each of them, it says that they are to be the husband of one wife. That's pretty clear, although today you wouldn't know that in a lot of other contexts. Again, it's a matter of how far do you take, assuming there's an element of cultural conditioning in all of this. So I realize this is not an easy issue to deal with. But again, we want to try to distinguish the principle and the practice and see what is intended to carry over to today. And then a concern about continuity. That is, putting the different passages together that address some of these same things. There seems to be some element of discontinuity as it relates to Paul's teaching between what is noted here and some of that which is stated in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and chapter 14. The first issue is looking at 1 Corinthians 14, 34 to 35. It says, "Let your women keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but they are to be submissive, as the law also says. And if they want to learn something, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in church." Now, if you take that as just what it says, then it should be really quiet. And there was silence for about a half an hour. I read that in the book of Revelation. And some have argued that it was because there were no women there at the moment. That is a joke. Okay. In this passage, it sounds like Paul is expecting the women to be completely silent. He uses a different word here than that which is found in 1 Timothy chapter 2. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, it's hysekia, and it has the idea of to be quiet. It's also found in chapter 2, verse 2, where it talks about the... it says, this is prayers are to be made for kings and for all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness. That has more the idea of quietness or lack of disturbance, of being in place and not disruptive. And so is that all there is to it? There seems to be a thing. What I would note is, again, there was a different problem, apparently, in the Corinthian church as they're compared to the Ephesian church. And perhaps Paul was imposing a stricter standard on the Corinthian church because of the turmoil that was going on there and the problems, the nature of the problems that were going on. Some suggest that Paul meant that the women should not take part in judging of the prophets. 1 Corinthians 14:29 references that idea, which would then be an exercise of authority in the church. And some would note that the context would seem to favor that. So it may be that Paul did not mean that women were to be absolutely silent during the service, but to exercise a quiet or submissive spirit and to be under authority. And of course, many would argue that. Again, what is the overlying principle? Is it not that of submission? And what does that have to do with? We'll have to look at that when we come to the next passage. First, some observations. Some of what was problematic in Corinth are not necessarily an issue for us today. So whatever the issues were may or may not carry over directly. There were cultural expectations regarding women's participation in various areas of life then and there. In that situation, in that part of the country, that's still the case. There are far more limiting expectations as far as women. Some of it related to the religion of Islam and its influence in that area, some of that which has just carried over from time past and part of that overall culture. On the other hand, just because our culture isn't quite the same, does that nullify the expectation if this is what the expectation is? And that's what we have to determine. So we must distinguish the primary principles that are timeless and the practices which are temporal and cultural. And I note, not an easy task. And that is why we have such a great amount of conflict and differences of opinions on this issue. Now, another passage to take a look at, 1 Corinthians 11, 2 through 16. I'm not going to look at all those verses, just a few of them. It says, "Now I praise you, brethren, that you remember me in all things and keep the traditions just as I delivered them to you." He was thinking of certain things the way he was expecting them to be. "But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." What's he doing there? He's laying out the basic principle. This is the principle. And then he's going to go into some illustrations and applications of that. He says, "But if anyone seems to be contentious," this is at the end of this section, after he gives his arguments that would support the principle that he's giving, And the focus of our context is the head of woman is man. But note where he starts with the head of every man is Christ. And if you don't get that right, then you're going to end up with problems coming down the line. And the head of Christ is God. Then verse 16, but if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. There is an expectation there. So let me note some brief thoughts and analysis here. Verse 2, there was a concern to keep the traditions. Verse 3, the principle of the passage is headship. That's the whole thing. God has put certain things in order. That is his divine design. Okay, everything else has to fit within our understanding of that basic principle. And if we keep that in mind when we come to 1 Timothy and when we look at Ephesians and Colossians, then those things make more sense. And it's this: Christ, then man, then woman. That's the divine intention. That's clear. So then verses 4 through 7, there's a cultural argument. Deals with head coverings. That's just the way we do things. Biblical argument, creation order. Man was created first. Woman came along to complement him. And so there was something in that order, the priority. And that, but he also continues on and says there's also an interdependence. Man can't continue without the woman. Right? Got to have the women. They're kind of important. Because life comes to an end. So keep that in mind. Verses 13 to 15, the natural argument. Women generally have longer and faster growing hair than men. And some of us men make it more obvious than others. Because it's gone or going fast. Conclusion, verse 16, avoid contention and follow convention, the convention of the churches. That's the essence of what he's saying there. The principle is headship. This is the order that God has put things in, and there's an expectation for authority and leadership associated with that. Then, finally, the third section, and we're somewhat, whether we're on time or not is another issue, but we're at least moving. The rationale for submission and in priority and functionality. This is another interesting passage here, verses 13 through 15. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. Same argument that was used in 1 Corinthians 11, talking about the headship, the order God had set things up in. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression. Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. Hang on. Trying to deal with I think verse 15 is a very interesting one. So he's basically giving two reasons here why women should conduct themselves in church meetings as he specified, why this order is understood in the context of the church. First is the creation priority, also referenced in 1 Corinthians 11, 9. The original design implications. From creation, it was God's intention that the male should lead the female, as we go back to the book of Genesis. He reminded his readers that God made Adam first and then made a suitable companion for him in Eve. God made Eve for Adam, not Adam for Eve. This implies no essential superiority. God created Adam and Eve as equals in the sense that they needed and complemented each other. However, God entrusted Adam with leadership as a responsibility over his wife and over creation. Now, you remember back at this time when Adam was created, he was given responsibility over creation. to name things, to handle responsibility of things. So that was part of the creation mandate, if you will. So Eve was not responsible to God for Adam in the same sense that Adam was responsible for Eve. And that would seem to be still true today. Matthew Henry, in his commentary, notes this. He said, "The woman was made of a rib out of the side of Adam, not made out of his head to rule over him, nor out of his feet to be trampled upon by him, but out of his side to be equal with him, under his arm to be protected, and near his heart to be beloved." Well, that's kind of a nice statement. But it kind of encapsulates the essence of the idea that is communicated here. Judgment implications. There is a residual effect of the fall that is referenced here. As part of the judgment of Eve at the fall, God confirmed or made permanent the leadership of the male over the female. It was a result of her deception by the servant, by the serpent, that Eve fell. This does not suggest that God confirmed Eve and all women as followers because they are congenitally more susceptible to deception than males. That is fairly obvious. It's interesting, often women have this intuition factor. Some would argue it's because their brains are connected, the left side and the right side, and men's really aren't. I'm exaggerating a little bit. And so they can take a lot of things and put it all together, whereas men just kind of, you know, this single focus kind of thing, and they don't make sense of it. And so we are grateful for those of us who have a wife to keep us on track at various times. There's obviously no adequate evidence to support the sweeping generalization that women are more congenitally susceptible to deception than males, therefore. The hazard of false teachers. In Ephesus, in the church there, it appears that some of the women had been led astray by false teachers. Chapter 5, verse 15 would suggest that, and these false teachers themselves were misled by Satan, and so they also were deceived. Verse 14 then is likely a local reference to the deception of some women in Ephesus. Chapter 3 of 2 Timothy, verses 6 and 7, would be referenced in that regard. "For of this sort are those who creep into households and make captives of gullible women, loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth." That's pretty harsh stuff that he's saying there. That seems to be part of what he may have had in mind of something going on in that situation. The basic problem that I think we would want to recognize is that Adam made a mistake by listening to his wife on that occasion and not taking leadership. That's what's perhaps being argued. And therefore, that's perhaps what is at least partly in view in this situation. And therefore, those roles were validated. A necessary qualification. Some people conclude that women are to be under male authority in all areas of life, not just in church meetings, because Paul has appealed to creation and the fall for his argument. What I think we would want to recognize is the context has already pointed out that he's talking about the church situation. His reference to creation and the fall also seems to be pointing out the husband-wife relationship in that context. And so I think there's a household issue that also, the household of faith and the household of the family, that needs to be taken into account here. And so you don't want to take that too far. Then, functional compensation. Verse 15. This is obvious. This verse is subject to misunderstanding. It can be and has been misunderstood on different levels. Perhaps the best explanation of this verse is that God promised women a life of fulfillment as mothers in the home, provided they walk with the Lord rather than as teachers and leaders in the church. Now, there's a word that's used here that seems to be a difficult one for people to deal with, because we have a connotation in our mind. Whenever we see the word saved, we think Jesus saves, right? That's it. It's soteriological, and that's all there is. But it's a word that's probably more often, or at least as often, used for general deliverance as it is for eternal salvation. And we get ourselves into trouble if we translate or understand it beyond that. So we need to be careful to evaluate the context any time that word is used, as to whether it's talking about a temporal deliverance or a spiritual ultimate deliverance or a soteriological deliverance. Some argue that perhaps the idea here is more the idea of a spiritual health or a fullness or a fulfillment of meaning in life from that context. And I would argue that just the design of men and women would suggest that there is this temporal and hesitate to use the word psychological, but that kind of idea that is related to this, of this mental health benefit of fulfillment that's there. And then generalities and exceptions. If this idea is valid, that this passage is talking about in verse 15, her fulfillment in childbearing, what about those who are not able to bear children? Whether one is single or whether one isn't able to have children, does that mean they're not included in this? Now, I have to also point out that some would say they will be saved through childbearing. That is, they won't die in the midst of it. But we know that that's not true, because that's... Or if someone would say they'll be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. So if somebody dies in childbirth, it's because they didn't continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control. And I think, you know, you're going to have problems trying to argue that direction as well. So I think I'm wanting to bring it to a conclusion, since our time is gone. There's a few more things that could be pointed out or argued here. But let me just note concluding summary thoughts. Again, we need to be careful to balance that which we're looking at here and seek to understand, okay, what is God's ultimate expectation? What is it that he is wanting to communicate? That is that he has an order and a functionality that is put in place. There is this headship idea, and in the context of the church, that needs to be followed through as it relates to teaching and exercising authority that is been put in as man's responsibility, and the women have had the responsibility of raising children and all that's involved with that. That's the primary design and intention. And there may be exceptions. There may be things that come along. So we need to keep that in mind. So the focus then is, let me just note a couple of things here. Paul exhorted the males in the household of God, terminology he uses in 3:15, to function as mediators between Jesus Christ, mankind's mediator, with God and his people. That's part of that role. They should do this by praying, teaching, and leading the church with delegated authority. That is, it's delegated to them, and there may be occasions where they can delegate some as well. Women should concentrate on facilitating godliness in the church family as well as in their homes by learning, by cultivating good works, and by living godly lives. This is the hierarchical view of this passage, and that's what how I would understand it to be. There is also an egalitarian view, and that is that there is nothing in this passage that limits the role of women in the church. Just so you know, there is that view. You probably already knew that. But I think you essentially are saying that you don't believe what the Bible says, and you don't accept and take it for what God's intention is, and basically you're blowing off Genesis chapter 3, as well as chapter 1, as well as chapter 2, as well as basically everything after that, because if you blow those off, then what else do you have? So it's really quite critical. And so it really comes down to, do we accept God's plan, God's design? And are we willing to see that as his purpose and focus in the church?